Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This week on Rewind, your week in review.
You're not going to have to fill out that crazy 4 or 5 page form anymore.
The effort to nix Wisconsin's personal property tax that businesses pay cleared committees with bipartisan support. Governor Tony Evers signed 4 policing bills into law, including one to largely ban the use of chokeholds. And Wisconsin health officials unveiled a plan to provide COVID-19 testing in schools starting this fall. Rewind, your week in review for June 25th.
I'm Brianna Riley.
And I'm Jessica Van Agren.
Jessica is filling in for J.R. Ross, who's on vacation this week, which means we are the first all-female co-hosting team of Rewind Your Week in Review. Exciting moment, Jessica.
It is. I'm glad to be part of history with you, Brianna.
Thanks so much for joining.
Yeah, glad to be here.
All right, let's get to the news this week. Lots of it. So we'll start with the effort to nix the personal property tax that has cleared committees with bipartisan backing. The legislature's Joint Finance Committee approved legislation to end it, which businesses pay, setting the push up for floor votes next week. The move came after the Senate Workforce Committee on Tuesday voted to advance the measure. The tax now applies to furnishings and equipment owned by businesses, and the bill would eliminate it starting in 2022. The legislation comes after the GOP-led Joint Finance Committee included $202 million in its budget to cover the costs of eliminating the tax. But the push didn't include language to repeal it, which then necessitates this trailer bill. Governor Evers hasn't yet said whether he supports the effort, and again, this will be voted on next week alongside the budget in the State Assembly and the State Senate. Let's head now to a video. Senator Dewey Strobel and Senator Brad Paff speak in support of the bill during Tuesday's Senate Workforce Committee hearing.
This is a process where we've put it in the budget, and I think we've got a path that I know we are committed to completing, which is the only way necessary to actually put an end to this tax. And this is one of the subsequent steps after the budget that we are now implementing to get to that point where we can tell our small businesses in the state of Wisconsin that you're not going to have to fill out that crazy 4 or 5 page form anymore. Send it to your accountant and spend a lot of money to end up writing a check oftentimes for less than $100 to your local municipality. We've also backfilled the amount to municipalities, just as we've done with that computer tax that was eliminated years ago. We continue to backfill that tax as is our intent to continue to do this tax in the future also.
I plan to vote for this measure. And I really do hope that, we do follow through with the revenue from year to year for our municipal governments, our local units of government. But I, too, have heard from my small business owners. I recognize the importance of this. But I do want to make sure that we keep whole our local units of government. So with that, I will be voting in support of this measure in committee.
This tax is one of Wisconsin's oldest, and decade-over-decade lawmakers have whittled away at it. For example, in the 70s, they exempted manufacturing equipment. In the 90s, computer equipment. And in the 2017-19 budget most recently, again narrowed. A segment of GOP lawmakers have been aiming to scale this back to nothing. And now, I guess that work has produced what we're seeing in this budget and in the trailer bill. What is significant about this current effort?
I think what is most significant to me is that in previous efforts, and this has been going on for about 100 years, that they've been, tweaking it, some people wanting to get rid of it. It actually first passed 170 years ago. So basically, 3 years after Wisconsin became a state, this tax came into existence. So just a little interesting, historic tidbit there. But what makes this one different is that for the first time, the state would be able to plug the hole, so to speak, of this personal property tax going away. So right now, it's the municipalities, obviously, that benefit from this tax. And in previous efforts, there's been no way to kind of back plug the money that these municipalities receive. And in this case, the Joint Finance Committee was able to allocate $202 million, which is the amount that the municipalities, you know, across the state spread out expect to receive every year. So, I mean, this is a one-time replacement. So, obviously, you know, that's still an issue. Republican Senator John Urbanbach was the sole Democrat. Did I say Republican earlier? I'm sorry, Democrat. He was the sole Democrat on the Joint Finance Committee who voted alongside with the Republicans to allocate that $202 million. The Democrats that didn't cited the fact that they were a little bit nervous that there was no direct link between that money and, you know, repealing this. So, you know, that's the big difference this time is that the municipalities for this one time are getting help.
Exactly.
And that's significant, you know, mm-hmm. because it's been a rough year, COVID, lots of services, lots of, you know, municipal level agencies need help. And at least this way, if this passes, they'll get it.
Exactly. And it's important to note the backfilling and how it does work, right? So mm-hmm. unless the state makes up for this lost revenue, it's on the burden shifts to homeowners, right?
Yeah.
So that makes it even more crucial, especially as you're looking at the individual tax burden mm-hmm. Across all Wisconsinites. But anyway, Republicans in their budget don't release, as you mentioned, the money directly to mm-hmm. municipalities. Instead, they would direct it to that supplemental appropriation. And
yep.
then it would wait until that trailer bill is passed and, mm-hmm. you know, the Department of Administration comes and asks for that money to be released for
yep.
the money to then go to the localities. So that's yep. that's the hurdle, really, that Democrats were trying to target in the Joint Finance Committee.
Mm-hmm.
They introduced an amendment to try to eliminate that and get the money mm-hmm. directly to localities. But as we saw on Wednesday, that effort didn't work.
No. And, you know, I think it's important to highlight just how much you know, local municipalities count on this. I found an article for a couple years back that stated that the tax actually accounts for just 3% of the state's overall tax base, which, you know, doesn't sound like a lot. But when you look at the municipalities and how much that fills their budget, I found some data that said that Green Bay, for example, it's 5% of their tax base, which comes out to, you know, about $6.5 million. For the city of Milwaukee, it's only 3.5%, but that dollar amount is even larger at about $26 million. So that's a chunk, and not surprisingly, given the amount of money that the city of Milwaukee receives from this, they were one of the entities that filed in opposition of this bill. But the bill does have a lot of support. There was like over 40 local state chamber of commerce that registered in favor of it. There is bipartisan support, like the Wisconsin Restaurant Association with Wisconsin Tavern League registered in favor of it. So it should be interesting to see how this shakes out when it comes to the governor's desk.
Exactly, and we'll have to see what Evers does with it when it does make it there
yeah.
in the coming weeks. So we'll keep an eye on that going forward.
Yeah.
Thank you for highlighting all of that. And let's now head to a video from Representative Evan Goyke. He speaks during JFC about this amendment, and Senator Strobel also weighs in. Let's hear from them now.
I would be okay with repealing the personal property tax if this game, if this maneuver that Republicans are using this time and haven't used in previous repeals was not in place, because it lacks the certainty and timeliness to local units of government. So adopt this amendment, and I'm all right. But put the funding in jeopardy or in delay or uncertainty, then I'm going to vote no, even though I understand the arguments about repeal, the full repeal of personal property. But this legislature has shown the right way to do it. Fund local units of government. Don't put it in the joint finance slush fund. Just do it like you did it in 2017.
Well, that's exactly the reason why we did it this way, because in the past we had a governor that supported repealing the personal property tax, and I'm not convinced that now we have a governor that does support repealing the personal property tax. So to avoid the risk of a line item veto, this is the only mechanism we have to do it. So, hey, if the governor would come out and state, yeah, I support repeal the personal property tax, we might approach this in a different way. But he hasn't done that, and so we can't take that risk. That's why we're doing what we're doing.
Governor Evers this week signed 4 policing bills into law. That includes one measure to ban the police use of chokeholds, except in self-defense and in situations where the officer feels their life is at risk. Evers had previously called for banning the practice without any exceptions. He also signed bills to require law enforcement to publish use of force data online, require DOJ, the Department of Justice, to collect and publish an annual report on use of force incidents, and compel that agency to distribute community policing grant dollars to communities. All 4 bills, I should mention, cleared the Assembly last week, teeing up this action this week. Other policing bills are also on their way to Governor Evers, including one that would penalize local governments for attempts to defund police. Another one would set a statewide use of force policy. That second one, which passed the Assembly, was amended on the floor following a request from the Milwaukee Police Union. What's the backstory there?
This bill, this amendment, this whole process relating to excessive use of force has been a big debate. We saw that this week, and even during the Racial Disparities Task Force, you know, defining what this means, how it's going to be, you know, how officers are going to have to, you know, monitor one another, monitor themselves. It goes back to what we saw following the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis. Obviously, there was one police officer there that was, you know, committing the murder, and then there was 3 other ones there kind of bystanding, not doing anything to come and change the situation. So this deals with that. What happened with the amendment, though, didn't quite make everyone too happy. It happened later in the day. The fact that it came from the Milwaukee Police Union, there was a representative of the Milwaukee Police Union that was on the Racial Disparities Task Force. And I know one Democrat, Representative Sheila Stubbs, who's the Democrat from Madison, wasn't very happy with the fact that this amendment was being brought to a vote on the Senate floor. She felt that it should have been discussed and debated at a task force meeting. And the fact that one entity, again, the Wisconsin Police Union, was able to bring their concerns to the Republicans kind of behind the scenes and get this amendment added. So essentially what it did is it changed 2 things. I think you mentioned earlier that the bill was amended to delay implementation until 2022. So that was the first thing. The other thing that it did is officers now have to, report colleagues who they see using unnecessary force, and then to intervene when they see colleagues use excessive force. But this bill would no longer require officers to intervene if they observe or reasonably should have observed reasonable use of force. So there's still this like really tricky wordplay going on here, like excessive use of force, reasonable use of force. And the fact that this amendment was made means that it's kicked back to the Senate. And I would suspect that there's going to be a bit more debate over those 2 terms before this is all said and done.
And as we're keeping an eye on that action, too, we're still waiting on the second subcommittee. So I guess to backtrack, we have the Racial Disparities Task Force right at the top.
Yep.
2 subcommittees formed, one focusing on economic development and education, which is, you know, its work is still pending, and the other one focused on policing and police policies. Can you sort of talk about that distinction and what we're waiting for?
Sure. So, you know, the Racial Disparities Task Force obviously was created in the wake of, you know, the national reckoning following George Floyd. Then Wisconsin experienced the shooting of Jacob Blake in Kenosha. Evers had some bills that he wanted, you know, he wanted to take action and reform policing. The Republican legislature decided that they would go with this task force instead. So the initial thought was that the bills for police reform would be ready January 1st for the legislature to vote on. So they were always kind of on this more stringent timetable. Like, I think the community activists, people that really are seeking reform, wanted to see action. So the task force, the subcommittee on police reform, you know, was striving to hit this January 1st start date to have these bills ready, let the legislator vote on them, get some changes passed, and show that this task force, you know, really meant business. Like, the quieter arm, I feel, of this task force is this second subcommittee that's trying to bring equity, equality to housing, education, things that we don't always want to tackle, but that have a direct correlation, you know, many people believe, to crime and, you know, other stats that end up, you know, leading communities to have interactions with the police. So that subcommittee is still going about its work. And I think that that's a good thing. You know, these are deeper community social changes that they're tackling. I mean, police reform is obviously a big topic, too. It's just that these two little buckets of reform, that police reform really had the spotlight on it. And the other one is still kind of quietly going on, doing its work. And it's definitely something we should watch for in the future, though, to see what they come up with. And, you know, it's good to know that this work is still going on and, you know, we'll have other bills coming out of this task force in the future.
Exactly, later in the session. So we'll see how they progress through as the session, you know, I guess does draw to a close in about a year ahead of the election. So we'll see how quickly they're able to introduce those bills and get them through the process in the months ahead. I appreciate you previewing that, Jessica. Let's move on now to other measures that passed the State Assembly and the Senate this week. For example, bills to tighten rules on absentee voting are now headed to Evers' desk. The Assembly Republicans approved along party lines a slate of bills to limit the timeline for and the number of ballot collection events, prevent election workers from filling in missing information on a voter's absentee ballot envelope, require so-called indefinitely confined voters to show an ID to vote absentee. This legislation, I want to note, is on its way to Evers just in time for the State Republican Party convention this weekend, where election integrity is expected to be widely discussed. And we'll talk a little bit more about that later. Anyway, back in the Senate this week, Republicans signed off on legislation to standardize recount pay for election workers and require localities to get approval from WEC, the Wisconsin Elections Commission, before renting private facilities to conduct recounts. Also heading to Evers is a bill to delay local redistricting and another to bar Wisconsin officials from enforcing future federal laws restricting or banning guns. That's an issue. That bill is something that we have discussed in passing here on Rewind, but we haven't really dug deeply in on it or talked about its, I guess, its relationship to other bills that are progressing nationally. Jessica, can you fill us in on the background there?
Yeah, so this bill goes by the so-called Second Amendment sanctuary state. So what that means is that the state would be exempt from any sort of federal gun laws that come into existence. Under the law, a firearm that is owned in the state of Wisconsin and doesn't leave the state would not be subject to any federal regulations. The measure also prohibits a person from enforcing a federal law or act rule that bans semi-automatic weapons, requires registration of firearms, or regulates capacity of magazines. The federal government would also be banned from prohibiting certain types of bullets, and the bill would ban the federal government from requiring the registration of firearms, like I mentioned earlier. The thing that I found so interesting about the bill that is making its way through the legislature here is that it assumes that there's going to be a legal challenge to this bill, so it specifically outlines, should said legal challenge occur, this is how to defend this bill in court. So, you know, they're prepared for a legal challenge. They know that this is probably, something that's a bit controversial, and they're including that in the bill as it's circulating. I think it's also important to note that the day that the legislature was discussing this, President Biden was outlining efforts to combat crime on the federal level, and a lot of that has to do with reining in semi-automatic weapons in light of all these mass shootings that we're seeing. So, you know, Second Amendment sanctuary cities have been a thing. There's about 1,200 of them now in the United States. The most recent state that I found that passed legislation like Wisconsin is debating now is Arizona, and they made themselves a Second Amendment sanctuary state in April. So this is definitely, I think, a trend that we're going to see more so in states in the upcoming months, upcoming years. And Wisconsin is just kind of, I guess, leading. The Wisconsin Republicans are leading the path following the suit of what happened in Arizona. So Yeah,
exactly. And this is, I guess, one of those bills that I think JR and I have previously categorized as fitting into the designation of veto bait in a way, right? They're yes. going to Evers. Evers, as a Democrat, may not be the most receptive to these sorts of measures. So we'll see. We'll see how that progresses in the weeks and months ahead.
Yeah.
But anyway, other bills that might also fall into that veto bait category are some of these election bills that are now on their way to Evers. Let's hear more from Representative Mark Spreitzer, a Democrat, and Assembly Speaker Robin Voss about those elections bills. They spoke about them ahead of the Assembly floor session on Tuesday.
Wisconsin's elections are run well, and our election results are extremely accurate. And the bills coming today do not make our elections more secure. They do not improve elections in Wisconsin. What they do is they make it harder to vote. They make voting harder for elderly Wisconsinites and Wisconsinites with disabilities. They make voting harder for regular people who make even one typo when filling out a form. And they make voting harder for people who want to help their friends and neighbors vote. And they make voting harder by taking away the innovations that allowed a record number of Wisconsinites to cast their ballots safely and securely during a global pandemic. These bills are designed to add more hurdles for voters to get over and more pitfalls that voters need to avoid. They are actively hostile to voting, to voters, and to the right to vote itself, and Democrats are proud to stand against these anti-voter bills.
I certainly think that every one of these bills should be signed by Governor Evers. I understand for those who think it's okay to have shenanigans in elections, they might want to allow the process to continue. But the very idea of saying that only a voter should be able to change their ballot, we should be able to have a reasonable limit for how far away you can have an observer to make sure that nothing bad is happening with the process, that we have indefinitely confined more clearly delineated so people can't choose to game the process as they did in this last election cycle. Those should be things that protect everybody, and we have no idea who they vote for, Democrats, Republicans, doesn't really matter. The goal is to make sure at the end of the day that every single person has the chance to vote, but that we guarantee that the confidence in the election, which has been severely undermined by the actions of a few over the course of the last election cycle, hopefully are a thing of the past.
Wisconsin health officials have unveiled a plan to provide COVID-19 testing to K-12 schools. Teachers, staff, and students at those schools would be able to participate in the program for the 2021-2022 academic year, the Department of Health Services announced this week. The program is free and participation is voluntary, according to DHS. Schools would be able to connect with labs, which would supply testing materials and folks to go to buildings to collect specimens. DHS is surveying schools this summer to determine which districts are interested and what each district's need is. The program would be funded by a $175 million grant from the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. It's been a while since we've had a COVID-19 update, so I took the liberty of taking a look at some data from DHS. So as of this week, our vaccination rate is 49.8%. That's the percentage of Wisconsinites that have received at least one dose of the vaccine. But then when you break it down by age groups, you see for the 12 to 15-year-olds, that's around 26.7%. And for 16 to 17, that's at 36.2%. So we're still sort of keeping an eye on those numbers, and health officials are too, as they've announced this program. But they're also keeping an eye on what's happening federally. Of course, what's going on in the background right now is Pfizer is still working on, I guess, approving a vaccine, approving its vaccine for the 5 to 11 age group that will hopefully be rolled out, or they expect would be rolled out in the fall. So that is when we would see vaccine eligibility really ramp up, according to Pfizer's current projection. And that's just in time for the school year to start.
Yeah.
What are you keeping an eye on as that population becomes eligible?
Yeah, well, I think what people are hearing about in the news right now, and maybe what parents should be most aware of, especially with a program like this. I mean, this is great. It's free. It's voluntary. Your high school, you know, your kids are going to be at school if they need the vaccine. It's right there for them. But I think what we need to be tuned into, at least even myself as a parent, what I would be watching is the issues that have been reported lately talking about heart issues. that come up with the younger population. So I think there's been between 300 and 400 cases reported. And what it is what's called myocarditis. So that's the inflammation of the heart. And when this happens, it's something that can frequently happen with any viral infection. So as we all know by now, COVID-19 is a virus. You can't treat it with an antibiotic. So like any other virus, this can and is happening. But again, very, very small percent. I think what parents and teenagers need to be aware of is that with myocarditis, what you're going to feel is like a shortness of breath. So, you know, your heart is expanding. It's inflammation. So you're going to be short of breath. You might have some chest pain or neck pain into your left shoulder. So if you experience that, you need to tell your parent, like be aware of it, tell your parent, and then call your doctor or go to the emergency room. You know, obviously, as I stated, cases have occurred. They are most often occurring after the second dose. So that's also something to be aware of. And days after, it's not like an immediate reaction. So that's something also to tune into, you know, 3, 4, 5 days after your teenager gets that shot, shortness of breath, my chest hurts, you know, take that seriously and get them to the emergency room so that they can get the care they need. And the folks that have been reporting this have mostly been young adult males, 16 or older, and then, so it's kind of that age group that's experiencing the most for whatever reason. But I think it's important just for parents to know the symptoms, know that this is occurring, and then to take action. And it's something that goes away, but it can obviously be scary if your, you know, teenage son comes to you and tells you that they're having trouble breathing and that their chest hurts, you know. But it's just good to be aware.
Absolutely. And I should note that, Jessica, you are a licensed nurse, so you're perhaps the most qualified person we've had on Rewind in the history of, at least over the course of the pandemic, to talk about these issues. So thank you for bringing your expertise to the table today.
Yeah, combining the two. So this is a good thing.
That's right. There we go. Politics and medicine, they're meeting right here. Here at Rewind.
That's right.
Anyway, let's hear now from Deputy Health Secretary Julie Wilms Van Dyke, who talks a little bit more about this program and the rationale behind it.
The program is designed to minimize the workload on schools so that Wisconsin educators can focus on what they do best, which is educating our kids, our state's children. The opt-in program will support schools to determine the best fit when it comes to testing options. They can select from diagnostic testing of symptomatic and close contacts, event-based testing, routine screening testing, or outbreak testing, or any combination of the above. And thanks to our robust partnerships with labs across our state and the lessons we have learned throughout the pandemic, this K-12 program is built on effective guidance and stands to make a real difference going into and throughout the next school year. The reason this is so important is just to remember that as I said in my opening comments, our children under age 12 are not yet eligible for vaccine, and our vaccine rates for children 12 to 17 are still only in around 25-30%, and much lower in some parts of the state. So this whole program is very important for us to be testing and detecting disease early in a population that is quite susceptible and that is in an environment that is susceptible to spreading disease.
Wisconsin Republicans are set to rally at the state party convention this weekend. Activists and elected officials will gather in the Wisconsin Dells for the annual event, which this year carries the theme Defend America, State, Local, State, and Federal. No current or prospective Republican gubernatorial candidates have been invited to speak. The convention is the first major GOP gathering since former President Donald Trump lost Wisconsin last November by nearly 21,000 votes. Expect to hear Wisconsin electeds talk about what they see as the failures of the Biden administration, the defund the police movement, border security, those sorts of things. Of course, there will also be a focus on Governor Evers as he prepares for 2022. Recall that he announced officially his re-election bid at the Democratic Party convention earlier this month. And then, of course, there will be an emphasis on southwestern Wisconsin's 3rd congressional district. I should note that Derek Van Orden, who lost to Kind, Ron Kind, the incumbent in that area, by less than 3 percentage points and has already launched a campaign to challenge him again is this year's convention chair. So there's going to be a focus on that race, especially as Kind remains one of the Republicans' top targets heading into 2022. And anything you're watching for in the convention this weekend, Jessica?
I think just to, you know, see how they position themselves heading into another election year. You know, obviously the governor's seat is something that they're looking to win back after having Scott Walker in place, as you mentioned, that Senate district. So it'll be interesting just to hear kind of what we can expect to hear on, during those campaigns. You know, I think the themes that you brought up, defund the police isn't popular, election integrity, a lot of these things that we're seeing making their way through the legislature are now streaming into the convention. I'm sure they'll stream into some of these campaigns as well. So, you know, just looking for kind of a hint at if that'll continue and what we can expect in some of these big races coming up.
The early themes and the tones that we'll see play out ahead of the, I guess, the 2022 midterm process.
Yeah.
Great point. Thank you so much for joining me, Jessica. I really appreciate it. I'm Brianna Riley.
And I'm Jessica Van Egren. And I'd like to take a moment just to thank Brianna for what she's done for the Wisconsin Eye family. She started co-hosting in February, and today is actually her last show. She'll be taking a new position in Washington, D.C. So just wanted to take a moment to thank you and wish you good luck.
Well, thank you, Jessica. Yes, so JR will be back next week with a new co-host in this chair, so we'll have a rotating cast, I guess, as the budget wraps up in the coming weeks. But thank you all so much for tuning in, and thanks for welcoming me to this chair over the last few months. I really appreciate it. Anyway, that's Rewind, your week in review for June 25th.
Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.